Welcome to CompTIA's Shark Bites podcast with Alan Shark, Executive Director at the Public Technology Institute.
Hi, everyone. This is Alan Shark. I am the Executive Director of the Public Technology Institute, now part of CompTIA. And we are here with another episode of Shark Bites, one of CompTIA's newest podcasts. And we've been doing a series that have been somewhat COVID-related in terms of the impact because it has been so dramatic in terms of change. And we're looking at it from many perspectives from people all over the country. And we are so pleased today to have Brian Mora, who has agreed to be part of this. And Brian and I go back probably about 14 years when I met him at an ICMA conference. He's been very active with the International City County Managers Association and the equivalent groups in the state of California where he resides. When I met him, he was the assistant city manager of San Carlos in California. But as I would learn, as I got to know him better, that he was really the kind of acting CIO at the same time. He was the financial manager, the HR director. He was the parks and recs director. But he also has an experience of being in a big city like San Francisco, which is a city county, the city of Hayward. He's been in the school district. And I was fortunate enough to work with the chairman of the board of PTI before we moved in with CompTIA. And Brian, for a number of years now, came to PTI as a board member and as an officer of the board as secretary. So, Brian, welcome.
Thank you, Alan. It's great to be on Shark Bites.
So I did a very quick overview. Did I leave out anything that you'd like to add to kind of set the stage for the views in which you are about to share with us?
Well, I think you covered the highlights. I mean, I think the thing to know for folks is that I've worked, as you said, in school districts and counties and cities over the years. And about 7 years ago, when I left San Carlos, I joined a company called an agency called Regional Government Services Authority. And what RGS does is provides services and mentoring and training for cities, counties, local governments throughout the Bay Area, and I've worked with a number of them since. And because over my career, I've worked, as you pointed out, a number of areas, whether it's been as an assistant city manager, as an interim city manager, as a finance director, economic development director, et cetera, I bring a lot of different tools and perspectives to challenges. And of course, what we've experienced since mid-March here with the COVID pandemic, a lot of those tools become very valuable in that work.
I'm assuming the work you're doing is going to become even more critical as people have to renavigate. I'm going to use the word renavigate as we kind of figure out what's the new normal and what is the impact going to be. I think you and I kind of agreed that the theme here would most likely fit under the future of local government. Mm-hmm. And you have been a proponent. You have share with me over the years some incredible examples of cities and counties working together and maybe sharing a sheriff's department. And, right. I think local government's been way ahead, especially California, in shared services. When the federal government talks about shared services, they're talking about sharing an HR function or a copier. Right. We're talking about something very different. Mm-hmm. With these pressures, do you see shared services increasing and becoming more desirable or maybe driven by necessity?
Well, I think what you're going to see is a lot of it's going to depend on, in the short term, and whether agencies have done this before. I'll give you an example. In Marin County, I've done some work recently with the city of Sausalito. Very shortly after the pandemic hit and the revenue losses started, they began to have discussions with a neighboring city, the city of Mill Valley, about sharing a couple of positions, a detective position, two motorbike positions, and they put together a shared services agreement pretty quickly. And that's because in Marin County, you have a group of smaller cities. They've been doing shared services for years. They were pioneers in that area. So for them, it's a matter of course. It was one of the first things they'd think of. On the other hand, there are other cities and counties around the state in California that have either limited experience in this area or have never done it. And so I think for them, a discussion of shared services or contracting may come much later. But as you mentioned, certainly when we were in San Carlos, what happened, which is another interesting case study, is in that city, there was an economic downturn. the city council went to the voters multiple times for different revenue measures, you know, sales tax measure, property tax measure, and they kept getting voted down. And finally, we had a meeting with the city manager and the finance person and myself. And when we talked about what was the next step, when we talked about revenue options, I said, I think the answer from the voters is no, that's off the table. And we had been cutting several years in a row. So I said, I think the only path left is to look at shared services. And what was interesting about that particular case study was that the city had a structural $3.5 million deficit. And by contracting for landscape services, and by that I don't just mean median, you know, landscaping as you'd see in many cities, but actually contracting out the landscaping for all of the parks of the city and transferring the police function from a city police department to the sheriff and transferring the fire department from a shared fire department to a another city, a larger city, the city was able to more than close that $3.5 million gap over a year and a half. And in fact, one of the more fascinating discussions that, that we had during that process is when we approached the county sheriff and said, is there a possibility that you could provide police services and hire all of our people and move them into your system because you have vacancies, you know, kind of a, hopefully a win-win circumstance, and we'd like to save $2 million a year. His initial response is that all you need to save? And I think we're kind of startled, like, a bigger pardon, what did you say? Because he said, we could save you more than that. And we found the same was true when we did fire, and the same was true we did. So we ended up saving much more than we thought. And when we put all of that together, the city ended up on a much better path because we more than covered the deficit and we were actually able to increase services at the same time we cut costs. So shared services is a powerful tool, but not every agency is ready to go there. And what I've seen in the current situation, and again, the pandemic obviously came on very quickly for everyone, was that the first thing that happened is people looked at their reserves. And the thing that I think many cities and counties and local government agencies have been fortunate, relatively speaking, is that, as you probably know, for the last several years, we've been in an up economy up until, you know, very recently. Cities and local governments have been able to build up reserves. And so most of them have some sort of a, you know, unintended downturn reserve. And so when this happened in mid-March, they thought, well, heck, we're going to use some of that reserve, and that'll take us to June 30. Maybe things will be better then. And of course, as we June 30 is approaching, we realize, no, that's not where we are. So now the most of the activity is to work on budgets for next year, or 2020 to 2021, from July 1st to June 30. And there, what we're seeing in most agencies is kind of what I would call a mix. They're using some of their reserves, but they're starting to do cuts. They're starting to do, you know, reducing work hours, layoffs, reducing services. In fact, one of the interesting data points I can share with you from the League of California Cities, they did a survey and they asked the cities, there's like 483 cities in California, how many of you are going to reduce services or have furloughs or make other reductions next year? And 90% of the cities said they were going to do that, 90%. And then they asked, how many of you have lost money as a result of the pandemic? And that was even more amazing. The answer was 100%.
Yeah.
They could not find any city in California that had not had a significant revenue loss. So that shows you kind of the magnitude. But I think what's interesting is in the upcoming year, 2021, you're seeing cities sort of do a mix. They're offsetting much of the loss with their reserves still, but they're also starting the service cuts. So the real challenge is going to be, and again, no one knows at this point, I would suggest, how long this will go on. If the pandemic goes on beyond next year, that's when the real crisis is going to be, because then that reserve, which is sort of cushioning the blow a little bit, even that's not going to be available to most cities.
Well, then, Brian, yeah. And we have the CARES money. So in other words, we have, it's almost as if we've been given some sugar to kind of keep us going.
Well, but you know, what's interesting about the CARES money, I'll give you a statistic I just heard from NLC, the National League of Cities. Mm-hmm. The CARES money is, at least the ones that have happened to date, are primarily going to the biggest cities only. So for example, NLC will tell you that, there are 19,000 cities in the U.S. I did not know that, but that's what they say. Of the 19,000 cities in the U.S., only 39 have gotten CARES money from the federal government. So unless a state gives some of its state CARES money to cities and counties, which, you know, could happen, but for the most part so far has not, because of course states also have deficits, the CARES isn't really helping at the moment. Now, there's been talk, of course, of a further CARES Act down the road, which would give more money directly to cities on a per capita basis. But right now, with the CARES work that's to date, only 39 of the 19,000 cities have CARES. So most cities are like, we're on our own, man. The feds are not going to help us.
So it's interesting. I'm trying to remember back to 2008, 2009. We both, you know, went through that. And it was interesting to see the budget cuts. I mean, there was a recession. That's why we used the 2008, 2009. I think the businesses started feeling it, and then government felt it a year later. It was a cleaner kind of cut. It was limited to the banks and real estate, the collapse of the real estate market. But it did lead to some painful cuts. Over a million workers were let go, public workers. And I think when you talk about building reserves, it was like that. It was like that depression mentality that they wanted to build the reserves because of what happened then. Now, things are different. It's not the same as it was in 2009.
Well, no, and the thing that was distinguishing about that particular downturn was it was primarily impacting cities where most of their money came from property taxes, from housing values. And what was interesting in the Bay Area is if you were along the corridor where you had all the tech companies, those home prices pretty much held their value. So most of the cities along that corridor weren't that impacted, frankly. But on the cities that were outside of where all the tech companies were, that were in the areas where housing prices were lower, where the houses were maybe not as, there's not as many sales, they fell much more dramatically. And those were the cities that got clobbered. And the same, you know, and it was yet different again in 2000 when we had the dot-com crash, where most of the cities that were impacted were the cities that had tech companies. So the cities, if you were in Silicon Valley, you got nailed. Whereas if you were outside of Silicon Valley, you had a downturn, but not as dramatic. And the other thing I noticed is that it's interesting that each time there's one of these downturns, you know, you talk about changes in the public sector, you also see changes in the business sector too. So for example, in the dot-com crash, when Silicon Valley came back, the venture capitalists not only put money back into some tech companies, but the mix changed. You know, instead of hardware, there was a lot more investment in biotech, health sciences, in, you know, addressing climate change and green companies that hadn't happened before. So the tech sector changed just like the public sector changed. And the same is true, you know, in 2007 and 8 is when the money came back. Again, the number of you know, loaning institutes and people doing mortgages, you know, dropped, and that mix of businesses changed. And of course, cities, as you say, obviously they had to make some adjustments as well, particularly those that were impacted. And I think we're going to see the same thing coming out of this, you know, crisis, in that cities that are very dependent on the categories that are most impacted, things like, you know, cities that have a lot of restaurants, have a lot of hotels, have a lot of travel, have a lot of car dealers, auto malls, shopping malls are the most impacted, but those that have some of the business categories that aren't suffering as much won't. But there's also some interesting changes on the business side about people working from home. And, you know, it's happening.
I was going to say that, Brian, because I think one position I would not want to be in anything in the United States would be that of a commercial realtor. Because I'm talking to people both in the public sector and the private sector. I'm going to let you finish your thought, but I just wanted to get in there. And they're talking about, they're realizing they don't need to have all that office space anymore.
Right, right. Well, and it's kind of I've talked to some of those folks too, and it's kind of a mixed blessing or a quandary. And they have their thinking caps on going, so how's this going to work? On the one hand, we can't have all the tightly packed cubicles, assuming social distancing lasts for any period of time. So people will need more square footage for their business. On the other hand, now that more and more people can work from home or are realizing that, we'll need less. So it's sort of like, so how is that going to land exactly? And what's that going to do to the value of office buildings? What is that going to do to the square footage rates that you charge, kind of to your point? And I think that also has a carryover effect for local government in terms of, you know, there's some cities that prior to the pandemic were busting at the seams in their government buildings. And we're thinking, gee, we're going to have to lease more space, or we're going to have to build a new city hall because we're running out of space. Well, now that you realize that a lot of your employees can work offsite, that might delay your need for a new facility. But again, the flip side of that is, but the agencies that have a lot of cubicles, they have to spread everybody out. So again, when this, you know, it's sort of like when all of the music stops and people, you know, it's like a musical chairs game, they all sit in their chairs. We'll have to look at how that all shakes out. But you're right.
And will there be a floor? In other words, will there be a definitive end? Will somebody be able to put a flag down and say, we're done, as opposed to this thing dripping on? And because uncertainty kills business, and therefore uncertainty will really harm government as well. And local governments are particularly vulnerable because, you know, they can't just keep raising property taxes. No one's occupying the property. The public wants more services and they don't want to pay for it. So right. I guess when we talk about the future of government, you know, everybody wants their own government. Everybody wants their own police cars with their own emblems and badging. Everybody wants their own fire department. Everybody wants their own computer. And technology, I think there's a number of people think, oh, we've risen to the occasion. For the first time, tech has really been recognized in ways that I couldn't even thought. I mean, people say, wow, you guys really did a great job. But they're not immune. They're not immune. I don't know if the smaller communities can keep up with the cyber threats and everything. I mean, I guess I come back to shared services or the future local government. Something's got to change. And do you see other ways in which that's going to happen?
Well, a couple things. First of all, you're very right about the identity, and that is one of the big challenges in the shared service proposal or model, in that people are afraid of losing their identity. But I have to tell you a great story along those lines when I was in San Carlos and we did the shared services project with the sheriff to kind of ease the transition, you know, moving all of the officers to the sheriff and all of that, is we started out by keeping all the same police cars. And what we did is we phased it in. So first of all, we had a changeover date, but we didn't tell anybody when it was. We just quietly did it. It was like a soft launch, as it were. The next thing we did is we had a mixed force so that we sent half the city police folks to county functions, and half of the people policing the city were now from the sheriff. So it was a mix, again, transitioning. And then by using the same cars, we kept the city seal on the door, but then we changed the slogan on the fin and we changed the logo on the back. So it was like a partially city, partially county car. But because the thing most people paid attention to was the city seal, nobody noticed that the sheriff's seal is actually on the back now, and the motto was no longer, you know, serve and protect. It was whatever the county's mission statement was. And so this started out, and people said, well, when's the change happening? And we said, already did. And they were like, wait a minute. But the other thing that happened, and the big win was, because we were now getting police services from a larger agency, they had more people. So we didn't have to worry about things like sick leave or people on vacation or comp, because we had a level of service agreement, you know, LSA, just like you'd have in a tech agreement, that they would provide a certain level. And because we got the budgeted level of service versus what used to be the actual, we actually had more service than before. And people were like, what's going on? Is there more crime? Look at all these police cars running around. And that was part of it. And so I think, you know, in other areas outside of tech, you know, the identity, you're right. And the more high profile the service is, the more important the identity becomes. I think moving over to tech, you know, we've already seen a number of interesting things go on. The first is, I think that as much as every agency has some form of IT, whether it's by contract or internal, is IT, as you might imagine, is a lot more important these days, a lot more popular. I suppose pre-COVID, it wouldn't necessarily be the case that certain members of the city organization or even the perhaps council members would know the names of the IT staff, but they know them now. You know, they're on speed dial. Everybody has the cell phone number of the IT manager or the CIO. That wasn't the case pre-COVID. And I think the good news is that the IT folks have, the ones I've worked with, have really, I think, stepped up to the plate and have really, you know, responded to this. And of course, they've been called upon. You know, we need more software licenses. We need more Zoom licenses. You know, what kind of connectivity do we have if I work from home? How do I get the files on the share? Do I need a VPN or something? So those folks have been working pretty long hours, but I think it's kind of like this was the moment for IT to shine. And I think the good news is, so far from what I've seen.
Oh, they have, Brian. They have. And the vendor community has shined. I have to say the vendor community has really come through by donating equipment, express shipping things, loaning equipment. I mean, they've done an amazing job. But nevertheless, moving away from the happy, you know, examples, and there are plenty. I mean, this is a moment to shine. You know, in 2008, 2009, you know, I was always been frustrated with the government approach to there will be 10% cuts across the board. Yeah. And I'm thinking, you know, you don't do that for public safety. And I'm hoping that if that mentality makes its way to this crisis, that there will be cutouts, that they will look at technology as being much more highly regarded and not be as vulnerable. Not to say they're immune for cuts, but it's like, we're going to have to be supporting a mobile workforce more than ever before, even when the COVID is declared, you know, gone. We're still, I think we're going to be skittish for years to come, just like people who went through the Depression were known to put whatever money they had under the mattress, an old joke. But if anybody knew somebody, that generation, they were changed forever based on what they saw. So my question is, unlike, you know, logos for cities and counties, which are very important to the community. You know, if I buy a fishing license in the state of Virginia or I buy a fishing license in Montana, chances are it's the same company. I'm seeing a website that is totally pushed out as if it's, you know, Virginia Game and Fishery and it is, but there are some companies that have been very clever and they're administering, they're taking the money, they're offering the different variations of licenses. And the same thing could be done on the technology, because logos can be addressed electronically. So do you see the possibility, if things really get bad, just like the shared services occur on the physical layer, that this could happen on the technology layer?
Well, I think in terms of the physical layer, we've already been seeing a lot of that. Certainly in California, there are companies, for example, that manage the business license programs for smaller communities in particular. The services completely outsourced, much as you'd see in the software world, the software as a service. You know, there's a website link, there's a phone number, but it's not going to your city hall. It's actually going to, say, Fresno or someplace in the central California, and they're doing all the renewals and collecting the money, but it has a branded website with your logo and all of that. So I think you're right. You'll see more of that. I think we're also seeing, you know, other vendors offer services like that again. So in some cases, it may be the case that it'll be a bigger city that'll be or county perhaps providing services for multiple cities. But in other cases, it may be a vendor. And I think as long as there is a connection with the city and that branding, you're going to be in good shape. So for example, the vendor who does the business licenses, there usually is like a liaison at the city. And there's also always the option of coming into City Hall and paying in person for those who really want to do it traditionally. Although I have to say that because of what's happened in this particular pandemic, where literally some cities, particularly here in the Bay Area, where we had the first stay in, you know, shelter in place order in the country, they just closed city halls completely for a couple of weeks. The assumption that you always have to have the option of coming into city hall is not necessarily there anymore. So I think it opens up a lot more possibilities. And the same is true with, you know, council meetings or board meetings. You know, it used to be the case that, you know, a council meeting or board meeting, you'd have to go to the board chamber. Sure. And you could send an email, but usually that didn't have as much impact. Now, all of the meetings are, in some cases, over tools like Zoom. And what I've seen is kind of a progression where when this started, first, all the people, of course, call the IT manager. How many Zoom licenses do we have? How do we get more, you know? And then it was, we're going to have a Zoom meeting to declare a state of emergency and to give everybody a COVID update. And that'll be it. And the council chambers will be closed. All the council members will be remoted in. The staff will be remoted in. but that's all we're going to do, you know. And then the next meeting was, well, maybe we'll put some consent calendar items on, because there's a couple bills we need to pay, and that's not controversial, and it's routine, and, you know, that'd be okay with a Zoom meeting, but nothing else. And we even had people in some cities, public, coming in and saying that, well, you can't, you know, do all business this way, of course. You just do the routine stuff. You have to hold off on the budget or the general plan or whatever until later. And then the next meeting, they said, well, let's do some routine business and see how that works. And then, you know, a couple more meetings. I mean, now we have cities that are in fact adopting the budget. They are in fact working on the general plan, the most controversial items, and people are used to it. And you know, they're testifying, you know, over Zoom. And so,
Ryan, even more than that, we're seeing a tenfold increase in citizen participation. You know, it used to be that these meetings would go all night. They still might, but the fact that you can Zoom in or WebEx in or go to meeting, it is really catching on. I mean, I've had people, city managers, say, I've never seen such participation or at least interest. So yeah, there's a real upside to that.
I think so. And the question is going to be, when we're on the other side of this and City Hall can reopen, are they going to perhaps, some cities say, well, we'll have in-person meetings again, but now we're going to give you the option of testifying over Zoom. So you don't have to come down to the City Hall or wait through a whole meeting, or you can be doing something else until your agenda item comes up. So it does do that. I also wonder, too, if some of the, I don't know how to put it nicely, but perhaps some of the groups that meet less frequently, some of the committees and commissions, you know, not the city council or not the planning commission, but some of the groups that meet a little less frequently, maybe those would be done remotely. So I think it does open up a whole new, you know, discussion. And the same is true with city staff. I mean, I'm sure most people are hoping they'll be able to come back to City Hall and see their coworkers and work in the traditional way. But I know in talking to one city, talking specifically about the IT group, the software developers said, well, you know, we don't really need to come back. I mean, we're just coding. I mean, we can do this from home permanently.
Well, or somewhere else. I had a CIO on this program tell me that she thought that this could open up a whole new set of opportunity to hire people to go to these remote locations where they could pay, but no one wants to move. So if it's coding and there's certain back office functions where this could be a win-win for somebody in the middle of nowhere, to the middle of nowhere. And so it opens up talent base in an amazing way.
I think that's exactly right. And actually, I think about, you know, in the Bay Area, certainly there are people who commute from long distances for any number of type of jobs. And again, it depends on what the job is. There may be some categories of positions where it's not feasible to have somebody go to a work, you know, live workspace or from home and remote in. On the other hand, you're exactly right. In some of the harder to recruit positions, say in technology, for example, where people are very comfortable, you know, working remotely, this might be your chance to snag a very talented person who would not be willing to drive as far as all the way to your city hall and all the way back and spend hours in traffic each day.
Yeah. We're in the middle of nowhere in Montana. Very happy to be there and loving it and willing to maybe make a little less for a full-time job with benefits where they can get telemedicine right to their door wherever they are. It's very interesting. So a senior advisor to RGS, where do you see some of your consulting shifting? In other words, you're going to see some new opportunities because they're going to need people like you with incredible experience. How do you see some of the assignments that you've taken on in the past shifting as you look forward?
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen in a big way in terms of shifting has been more cities of all sizes interested in economic development. I mean, originally, we provided a lot of services in finance and HR. That was kind of the core mission. And then what happened is more and more people were saying, well, gee, can you help us out with a city clerk function or you know, community development, whatever. So we've expanded that way. But what I've seen in the economic development arena is that when I started in the profession years ago, only the biggest cities or the middle-sized cities had redevelopment or economic development. If you were small, you know, you just didn't have the funds for that. Now what everybody's realizing is that in many cities of all sizes, if most of your money comes from businesses, you now have a very critical relationship with your businesses. If they're not doing well, you're not doing well, and vice versa. I worked with a mayor when I was in San Carlos who was in the financial field, And he was someone who's very to the point. I always liked the fact he just got to business. And one of the things he said at one of his State of the City speeches, which I think is so true, is he said to the residents and the businesses, he said, the reason we have economic development and the reason that we work together as a team, and it's very important, is he said, remember, without revenue, there can be no expense. And everybody looked at him, and he turned to the city manager and says, isn't that right? And we said, that is exactly right. And suddenly people realized how important that situation is. So I think that's one area. But I think another thing that's happening, and this was happening, you know, before COVID, but continues to be a challenge, is the fact that so many people in the public sector are retiring from the field. In fact, in ICMA, they call it the next generation problem. The GFOA, the Finance Officers Association National Group, they call it the silver tsunami. You know, there are a number of terms for it, but so many people are leaving, and it's difficult to, in some cases, replace that institutional knowledge that is lost. And in some cases, particularly in those smaller agencies where you don't always have a career ladder, I've been in cases where they're trying to take someone and move them up two or three levels all at once because they, you know, they have a director need, but they have somebody, and sometimes you can expedite someone's development, and we've done some projects like that. In other cases, it's just, you know, not feasible, but it does get agencies thinking about, we have to create some career ladders here. We have to start developing the next generation of talent because, you know, we have a number of our most senior people, our key people who are leaving. And if they leave, you know, to continue the services we have, to continue those critical projects. And a lot of times that's the sort of adventure that I find myself in, where I come into an organization. It's kind of like coming into the middle of the movie. You know, you come in and they're saying, okay, we've got this ballot measure, we're going to raise revenue, and it's in 2 months, help us, you know, and you're like, oh, you know, or it's, you know, we've got this critical department head vacancy, and we want to keep some of these initiatives this person was working with moving ahead while we're recruiting for the replacement. So you're right in that there's certainly a demand for those kind of advisory training services, and that will continue. But also, I think that we're going to see a lot of discussion, as you were talking about earlier, about new ways of delivering service, new ways of structuring the organization, whether it's more people working offsite, whether it's looking at contracted or shared services, whether it's looking at cities merging. You know, I have a project coming up where I've got two special districts who are talking about merging again to capture some of those economies of scale. So yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities. And it also, I think, will be the case that the longer this goes on, the more of those discussions are going to happen. And while I know that these situations can always be seen as challenging, in some respects, there's also an opportunity, if you want to look at it that way, in that when you have a major budget downturn or crisis, sometimes this is an opportunity for you to propose something, if you're a member of the staff or department manager, where you might have had an idea about saving money or being more efficient, but politically you thought, oh, they'd never let me talk about that. Now, when the need is critical, suddenly you can put things, in my experience is, you can put things on the table that politically you could never bring up. And so that's, I think, another thing that we're going to see more of. In fact, one of the interesting projects I did in my last city is we went through a series of budget challenges. And each year we would come up with ways to either generate revenue or reduce costs. But the rule is you always had to have them pay back within 12 to 24 months, you know, quick payback. And once we went through all of those, everybody said, okay, now what do we do? And the thing I came up with, and we actually got an award for this, believe it or not, this idea, we call it the cost avoidance reserve, is we took a portion of the reserves the city had, and we put it into basically an internal venture capital fund. And what we said to the departments is, okay, we know that you've already given us all of your 12-month payback ideas, and even your 24-month payback. Now we want to see your 3 to 5 year payback ideas, and we'll fund those. But here's the little sort of clawback or the catch. We'll start deducting that money from your budget in the third, fourth, and fifth year. So it better work because we are going to reduce the cost. And we got an amazing response where people said, as a matter of fact, we do have a lot of those ideas, but we thought you folks and finance and the city manager would never entertain them because they don't have a 1 to 2 year payback. So it does have the potential of unlocking some of those, I don't know if you'd call them way out ideas, or those long, long payback ideas that normally would not be considered, but now everything's on the table.
I would agree, and we're going to leave it at that, Brian. This has been fascinating. We could probably do another session. Perhaps we should. We probably should have you back probably on the other side, as you refer to it. That's encouraging. It's nice to know there is another side. I believe there will be. I know you're an optimist, as I am as well. But we've been listening to Brian Mora, who at the moment is senior advisor to RGS. They do a lot of work in the Bay Area and elsewhere in California. And he's also been an assistant city manager and kind of a CIO. I don't know anybody who has worn more hats. If you had a hat rack, you would probably need 4 of them to do justice to what you do. Brian, I go back many, many years. You're listening to Shark Bites, and this is a podcast through PTI and CompTIA, and we broadcast every other week on Thursdays. So please subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. And this way you'll get notices on the next one coming up. Brian, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
This has been a production of PTI, the Public Technology Institute. To learn more, visit pti.org.